R. Dorothy Wainwright had lost track of Jay during the break, but that didn't bother her over much. He seemed like a decent enough guy, but it wasn't like she was here looking for romance, so it was no huge crisis that he'd dropped off her radar. He was probably circulating, too. That was what most of this crowd seemed to be doing. She wondered where Mickey and Caitlin had gotten to, but couldn't see them from her current position. Short of climbing onto a table, there wasn't really any way to see the front of the crowd, and she didn't feel like trying to push her way up there right now. Getting there would be easy. Getting there without just shoving everybody out of the way would take calculation. Instead, she made her way toward the bar, figuring she might ask Demetrios if he'd seen where either of her companions were recently. She was intercepted about halfway there by a familiar sandy-haired figure in a Toronto U shirt, who grinned broadly at the sight of her and pointed as if he'd just discovered the new world. "Hey!" he said, the crowd absorbing enough of the sound of the band from back here that it was possible to speak in a relatively normal tone of voice. Delighted. "Dorothy, right? It's me, Jeff. How you doing? Boy, you look terrific."
"Thank you," Dorothy replied blandly. "Excuse me."
"Heading for the bar? No problem. Let me take care of that for you. I know just the thing for a girl like you." He ducked away into the crowd with a hang-on-a-second gesture, and more out of curiosity than anything else, she stayed where she was. The band finished Power Dive and started another heavily arpeggiated song called Up and Down while she waited. And then Jeffrey appeared with a tumbler in his hand containing some clear liquid and ice. "There you go," he said, then repeated, "Just the thing." Dorothy took the glass, looked at it, and then, for lack of any particular reason not to, took a sip. Her face betrayed no outward reaction as the liquid passed her black-coated lips. She drank off about half of it, then lowered the glass and regarded Jeff with an even blank look. "That's not legal," she told him. He grinned. "I won't tell if you won't," he said, laying a finger alongside his nose and winking. "Say, you want to go someplace a little quieter and maybe talk? I never got a chance to tell you how badly you misjudged me the other day, what with your guardian goofball and all. Who was that guy, anyway? Your boyfriend?"
"I don't have a boyfriend," Dorothy said flatly.
"Oh, well, what a crime. Tell you what, why don't we go back to one of the rooms in the back and talk about that?"
Dorothy gazed unencouragingly at him for a moment, but it only seemed to deepen his interest. Finally, "All right," she said, "but I have to use the telephone first." She smiled very faintly and lied. "Tell my roommate I'm not coming home."
Jeff smiled. "Oh ho! You do that, kitten. I'll be waiting in the back."
He looked like he was thinking of leaning forward and kissing her before taking his leave, but she whirled and walked away before he had a chance, slipping through the crowd toward the bar. Demetrios looked up from wiping down the bar to see her emerge, a slightly darker than usual look on her face. She put the glass down on the bar, leaned toward him, and said in an undertone, "Put the telephone on the bar and listen to me carefully." Demetrios' eyebrows almost met. Then he nodded, said, "Of course, of course," and lifted the instrument from under the bar to place it on top. Dorothy picked up the receiver, dialed a number, and very discreetly thumbed the disconnect key as she put it to her ear. "Do you recall the man in the university sweatshirt and green pants?" she asked the deadline. "He bought this drink a moment ago."
"I know him," said Demetrios offhandedly as he wiped at the bar with his towel. "He comes in here most weekends."
"He gave me the drink. Vodka, I believe."
Demetrios frowned slightly. "How old are you?"
"Immaterial," Dorothy replied. "I'm a robot."
The bartender blinked. "Oh, then what?"
"Two reasons. He doesn't know that. And the vodka is spiked with subhypnogen trisulfate."
Demetrios' eyebrows crashed together like a country fair train wreck. "Suggestrol? Are you sure?"
"I am capable of analyzing several hundred thousand known chemical compounds," Dorothy replied. "Think of it as a highly advanced sense of taste. If not SH3, then a related compound. A high-powered suggestive psychoactive, at any rate."
"Where is he now?"
"Waiting for me in one of your back rooms. He thinks I'm calling my roommate to tell her I'm not coming home. He suggested we go back there and have a conversation."
"Oh, he'll have a conversation, all right."
Demetrios growled. Denise, take over! He barked to one of the waitresses. When Denise, blonde, late college, pretty, had done so, he marked the half-consumed drink with a grease pencil, put it in the small refrigerator under the bar, then took off his apron and came out from around the bar. You just leave this to me, said Demetrios. Didn't I promise I'd take care of it if anyone gave you a problem? That's why I brought it to you, Dorothy told him. My companions are having a good time. I don't want to disrupt their evening with a scene. Demetrios nodded, his face black with anger. You did the right thing, he told her. Don't worry about it. Then he plunged into the crowd and disappeared, heading for the back room. Dorothy stood and considered the situation for a few moments. She felt curiously uneasy for some reason. She'd never been in any danger. She was utterly immune to chemical intoxicants, after all, and possessed enough strength to ruin entirely the day of any human who tried to take anything from her by force. Nevertheless, she felt almost frightened. Not so much by the encounter itself, but by the thought of what could have happened had she been someone else. One of these others, the Torontonian girls, high schoolers and college co-eds in their combat boots and bangles, laughing and joking. Caitlin, at least, would have the sense not to drink anything a guy like that handed her, and she could do a fair bit of remodeling herself on anyone who tried it rough. But these other girls hadn't been brought up by a master martial artist and an honorary Valkyrie. They were so defenseless in a situation like that. She shook herself slightly, pushed her way with more surliness than she'd been wanting to display a little while ago through the crowd, and found Mickey just as up and down faded into a pretty, mellow, extended bass solo. Oh, hello, Dorothy, he said as he noticed her. Are you enjoying the show? For the most part, she replied. Will you dance with me? Certainly, he said, and she slipped into his arms quite naturally, since it was such a nice, sweet, slow piece. She refrained from putting her head on his shoulder, though, so as not to get makeup on his jacket. Kyoichi Sayonji was halfway back to his seat during the second period concessions, when it suddenly hit him. Good Lord, Tenjo, he observed as he got back and handed over her drink and nachos. Do you realize we were on a date? Utena stopped in mid-crunch of a nacho chip to give him a weird look, then wiped the resultant dribble of cheese sauce from her lower lip with her thumb, licked it off, and swallowed before saying, Do not scare me like that, Sayonji. Sorry, he replied, but, you know, technically we are. It startled me just as much to realize it. We are not, she replied irritably, crunching down another chip. I don't go on dates. We're just watching a hockey game. God, why does everybody always have to drag the whole boy-girl thing into everything anyway? Sayonji spread his open palms in surrender. Sorry, 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 he chanted. I wasn't trying to invoke the whole boy-girl thing. It's just that if you accept the definition that a date is a thing that two people do alone together... Which I don't, she interrupted him. Fine, but if you did, then... Oh, come on, ref! What does he have to do, take her head off? Slashing! Slashing! Bellowed Roy Chernov, who had quite diplomatically not heard any of the preceding byplay. Karen Torborg, who apparently agreed with Roy and Sayanji's assessment of the situation, dropped her gloves and took the law into her own hands with regard to Ottawa winger Alex Karnashevsky's repeated fouls. Oh, yeah! Utena shouted, coming to her feet with the rest of Section 118 and miming a decent right hook. That's the way! Moose says... Caitlin's impression of Moose must be heard to be believed, even with her stutter at the stranger level. Okay. We're here at Bathurst and College... The crush of love dissolved into gales of laughter, slapping their knees and each other's backs. Mickey, who had heard the story before, joined them all the same, and Dorothy looked fairly significantly amused. The little place in Chinatown Joe Groff knew had turned out, as Mickey and Kate suspected it would, to be Happy Seven. Joe had been startled and amused when the hostess recognized Mickey, makeup and all, deemed him adorable, and ushered them to a table. Oh, wow, said Joe as he got a control of his lungs back. Batherson's College, that's great. The one who spotted the sign, Utena, that's the girl you had selling your t-shirts and crystals at that show. Kate nodded. Mm-hmm. She's my roommate.
Joe grinned and nudged his rhythm guitarist with his elbow. Eric here tried to pick her up that night.
Joe, I did not!
Eric Arnoldson protested, his fair-skinned face going red.
Oh, sure, growled bassist Dom with a cruel grin. You only went up to her when the only shirt left was the one she was wearing and said, I'll take that last one. Can I take it home or do you deliver?
I was kidding!
Eric blurted.
Yeah, said Dom, smiling into her tea. Sure. Yeah, you some smooth, G,
remarked Jill in a high, amused Funkatron drawl.
Did she come up to Toronto with you?
Asked Joe. Kate nodded.
She's at a Leafs game tonight.
I wonder if she's enjoying it, Dorothy mused. At first, it was difficult to tell that anything odd was going on. After all, it was getting toward the third period of a hotly contested hockey game in a packed house with considerable numbers present cheering for both teams. Everybody was screaming. But presently, Utne became convinced that, yes, somebody was yelling at the top of his lungs and approaching their position. Only after the yeller in question reached the bottom of their aisle, pivoted, and turned to face them was she able to piece together, from the sight of what he was holding, exactly what he had been screaming as he ran down the aisle from the concourse at the top.
Crunch! And munch!
He finished this lengthy exclamation just as he made the pivot at the bottom of the aisle. Then he stood, a rather stocky individual, sweating profusely, staring at their section with wild, crazed eyes, wearing a red polo shirt, blue pants, and a large, soft-sided box with a Crunch and Munch logo emblazoned on it. He panted for a couple of seconds, then pulled a single box of the snack out of his pack box, brandished it like the Torch of Liberty, and bellowed,
Crunch and Munch rolls! Who wants some?
Crash! A senator slammed face first into the cluster behind the vendor. He jumped, then whirled and slammed the box logo side in against the transparent panel, right in the player's face, and yelled again,
Crunch and Munch rolls!
Damn, Sayanji, Utna muttered. This guy's crazier than you are.
Thanks, said Sayanji dryly.
Come on!
The Crunch and Munch vendor hollered, turning back to face section 118.
Who wants it?
Hands started going up, and the man started lobbing boxes of toffee-coated popcorn unerringly to their targets all over the section, using direct and indirect fire like a flexible missile system. Somehow, this bizarre spectacle didn't detract from the show out on the ice, possibly because the guy wasn't actually standing in anybody's way. He was conducting all of this business out in the aisle, which was wide enough that it wasn't anyone's sightline.
Is that all?
Demanded the wild-eyed vendor as he filled the last order.
Come on!
He plunged his hand into his pack, came up with another box, tore the top off with one violent gesture, and then climbed partway back up and thrust the box at Utne.
Take some!
He demanded. She blinked at him, startled. He rattled the box and thrust it toward her again.
Take some!
He screamed, not in a tone of command, so much as one of desperation. Trying not to laugh too hard, she took some.
Hey, this is great, she remarked. Try some, Sayanji.
All right, said he, and he did so.
Say, not bad.
Two, said Utne.
All right! Crunch and Munch rules!
Howled the vendor. He dispensed the two boxes and then made his way back up toward the concourse, serving the stragglers.
Very strange, Sayanji remarked as he ate his Crunch and Munch.
Odd how some people can completely abandon all restraint that way.
Hmm, said Utne between crunches.
Come on, ref! Drop the puck!
Caitlin finished scrubbing the last of the temp dye out of her hair and the makeup from her face, toweled off, put on her pajamas and robe, and emerged from room 2716's bathroom, feeling refreshed and pleasantly tired. Dorothy, who'd already divested herself of her clubbing clothes and makeup, was curled up on her bed in a nightdress Jury had helped her pick out, reading a book. She glanced up and smiled slightly as Kate entered the bedroom.
Did you have fun tonight, Dorothy? Kate asked.
Yes, Dorothy replied. She briefly considered relating to Kate what had happened to her at Sneaky D's. After all, as her custodian, Kate was responsible for her and should know about any such incident, but decided against it. It would just make her angry and ruin her evening, and for what? The situation was already handled and over.
Later, perhaps, some other day. Anyway, it wasn't a lie. Aside from that, she had had fun.
Well, that's good, said Kate. She sat down on the end of her bed and flopped backward, arms outstretched. I hope Utena and Sayanji get back soon.
There was a knock at the door, which meant it probably wasn't Utena. Kate made a disgruntled noise and started to rise, but Dorothy said, I'll get it, and then followed through on the promise. Miki Kaworu had scrubbed his face clean and washed the dye and gel out of his hair as well. In jeans and Worcester Symphony Orchestra t-shirt, he looked almost normal again. He blinked and reddened slightly at the sight of Dorothy in her nightdress, a floor-length, rather frilly affair in black and white silk, then followed her beckoning into the room, shutting the door behind him. He looked around, slightly awkward, for a place to sit, then settled on the corner of Kate's bed as Dorothy returned to her spot.
"Aw," said Kate, hitching herself up on her elbow to regard him. "You washed your hair."
"Of course I did," Miki replied. "Appearances aside, it was starting to itch. Besides, you've got pictures. I'm sure tonight will come back to haunt me for some time to come," he said with a smile.
Did you have a good time?"
"I did," said Miki, nodding. "I especially enjoyed talking with Mr. Groff and the others afterward. He has a lot of very interesting ideas about musical integration."
Kate sat up and nodded eagerly.
"Uh-huh," she said.
Especially...
With a private little smile, Dorothy tuned them out and went back to reading. About 5 minutes later, as Caitlin and Miki were deep in discussion of some arcane point of Joe Groff's use of minor keys, a small army of rabid Toronto Maple Leafs fans invaded the 27th floor of the Imperial Tower Hotel. Or at least that's what it sounded like from inside room 2716, but when the door lock clicked and the door opened, the boisterous crowd turned out to be no bigger than Utena and Sayanji. Miki and Kate sat on her bed and blinked at the two new arrivals in puzzled amazement. They were both wearing Maple Leafs sweaters, purchased at the Toronto Ice Arena gift shop after the game. Utena's was a road jersey, white on blue in the modern style, and bore the name and number of René-Philippe Tarchet. Sayanji's was the home type, blue on white, and in one of the classic styles with a vintage-looking number and letter font. Taking his cue from Roy Chernov, Sayanji had bought the sweater of number 29, Mike Pommettier. As they entered, the two were laughing uproariously over something. They tried to explain what, but without much success. Still, Kate got the distinct impression that they had enjoyed the game.
"Okay," she said, "bedtime, kids. Early day tomorrow. The zoo opens at 9, and I don't want to miss anything."
Miki nodded. "All right," he said, and got up. "Good night, Miss Caitlin, Miss Dorothy."
"You're doing it again," said Kate with a cautionary raised finger and a wry grin.
"Sorry," said Miki. "It's a very ingrained habit. I'll shake it someday." He grinned. "Good night."
"Good night, Miki, Sayanji," said Dorothy.
The five broke into their standard groups of 3 and 2 and tried to settle in for the night. Unfortunately, there was a problem. Those who had been to the hockey game hadn't had the wind-down period the club visitors had been granted by the fact that they'd left after the first band, and so were still wired by their experience. On both sides of the hall, the same sad little drama played out. They couldn't sleep, they couldn't sit still, and worst of all, no matter how much they tried, no matter how keenly aware they were of how excruciatingly irritating they were being to their roommates, they could not shut up. 20 minutes later, there was a knock at 2716's door, and Utena took a moment out from pacing and struggling to stay quiet to admit a bleary-eyed, pajama-clad Miki.
"Miki," Caitlin said, fumbling at her bedside stand and putting her glasses on again.
"What's the matter?"
"I can't sleep," Miki replied in a tone of misery. "Sayanji won't stop talking."
"Really?" said Kate. With a wry grin, she said, "Funny, I'm having a similar problem." She turned to Utena. "Utena, go bother Sayanji, and take your toothbrush." Utena opened her mouth as if to protest, then let it pass with a defeated smile.
"Okay, okay," she said, and collected that article from the bathroom. "Good night, you guys."
"Good night, Utena," said Miki. He got himself a cup of water from the bathroom faucet, then shut the door behind Utina as she went across to knock on the door of 2715. As he re-entered the main room, Dorothy got up and smoothed out the covers on her bed. "I guess it's the couch for me tonight," she said. Then she turned her dark eyes on Miki, a touch of an impish smile on her face, and added as he took a sip of his water, "Unless you'd rather sleep with one of us." Miki choked, spraying water in a rather picturesque cone, which fortunately missed both beds and the TV set, then spent a few minutes coughing and spluttering. Caitlin gave Dorothy a look that was a smooth blend of amusement, amazement, and admonishment, but Dorothy only looked calmly innocent in response. When Miki had recovered his ability to speak, he said, "That's all right, Miss Dorothy, I can sleep on the couch." "Well, all right," said Dorothy as she put one of her bed's two pillows at one end of the couch, then carefully extracted the lighter of the bed's two blankets and spread that over her makeshift bunk. Then she climbed underneath, arranged herself, and told him, "But one of us will probably fall off before the night is out."
Dorothy, stop teasing Miki,
Kate told her, but not with much of a straight face.
"Miki, go to bed."
"Yes'm," both said together, leaving Kate unable to decide at whom to throw her pillow. Finally she gave up, threw it at no one, turned off the lights, and went to sleep.